now, all you manger dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If you work, be not too shoddy. Be careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Halloween, Samhain, All Hallows, All Saints, or Halloween, is the season of the crone. In ancient paganism, the word crone denoted an elder priestess or tribal matriarch. A cognate word is crown, symbol of a leader. The word was made pejorative when the Christian church redefined all elder priestesses of the old religion as malevolent witches. Similarly, the word hag was once derived from Greek hagia, a holy woman, and also became a Christianized term for a witch. The divine crone was originally a part of the Trinitarian goddess, who appeared in maiden, mother, and crone forms. Associated with the three phases of a woman's life, the three phases of the moon, and the annual cycles of nature. Viewed as an underworld deity who cared for the dead, the goddess's crone ruled autumnal harvest festivals, when the spirits of dead ancestors could visit their descendants and share in the harvest feast. Among the Celts, the well-known death's head of the feast used to be an actual skull of an ancestor, set at the table to receive offerings, often with a candle set within it to simulate the warmth of life and the light of vision. Such was the origin of the jack-o'-lantern. Yes, my friends, it's that time of the year again, when ghouls and ghosts abound, and for many of us, things get a lot more witchy than usual. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Broadcasting today from under sinister spray, covering much of South Korea's skies, this is episode number 37 and our first annual Halloween special. I'm your host, Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tonight's guest, renowned mystic author, medium, poet, and esoteric historian, M. Teresa Clayton. We're waiting out here on the docks of Skullport Harbor. Pirate Larry, I see you there coming along the way. You were bringing a friend with you tonight here for this evening's show. Has she managed to make it along herself or not?
Yeah, she's here.
I am here.
Uh-huh. The old crone has managed to join us for this evening's show, so that's great.
A very special person I bring thee tonight, my friend. That's a very special.
That's excellent. And of course, as was mentioned in the introduction to the show, the word crone actually it's related to, I guess, the word crown, really. So not a lot of people think of it in a pejorative sense, I guess, as if it's a bad word. But I guess that's not really the case, Teresa, why don't you maybe kind of give us a clearer sense of where that all comes from and what the word's really all about?
Unfortunately, when the church took over and kind of absorbed all of the pagan rituals and Celtic rituals into their own, what they did was they bastardized an awful lot of the terminology used in witchcraft and in the metaphysical world. You're listening to my clock chime. I have five of them, I'm sorry. But the word crone, and that's what I am now, is a woman who has passed her prime and who has spent an awful lot of time doing a lot of research, looking for truths, and has become very knowledgeable. That would be in regards to Gnosis and Gnostic. Gnosis is knowing, Gnostic is the one who knows. And when you go to the crone, you're going to the top of the ladder. She knows everything. And so I'm very honored to wear that crown.
Mm-hmm. Top of the ladder, yeah, crown chakra, all those sort of good things, I guess. So, well, and it's great to have you join us today. Now, the thing is here, I guess the next step would be we have to make our way onto the Robin Hood. And the way that the captain has got things laid out here in the ship's articles is that guests are expected to provide some sort of pirate reference of some kind, maybe a story or a riddle or anything along those lines. You can do a jig or what have you.
Yeah, Miss Teresa has a pirate jig.
She
brought a pirate jig.
Is that the deal, Larry? Okay, all right.
Yeah,
so
she brought a pirate jig. It's a pirate jig we did together, and it's for the season, too.
What would that be? What are we looking at there exactly?
Well, it's a little tune we did. We did it together. It's called Witch. I think she published that in her book, Mystic Verses. It's a published poem. And then Piratas de Dios, we did the soundtrack and the vocals to it.
Okay.
So, Teresa can tell you, how it happened, how we met.
Sure, exactly. Why don't we hear a little more from her then on that front, exactly how the two of you did meet? Because I think you've known each other for a few years now from the sounds of it. Although, well, let's just hear, Teresa, if you don't mind, where it was. First crossed Larry's path.
I'm very honored to have crossed his path, and we keep crossing it. Actually, it was back in MySpace days, and I'm not real sure who connected with whom, but we ended up connecting. I really liked the sound of his voice and loved the way he played his guitar. He plays 12 string as well as the regular, I guess, 5 or 6 string, familiar with it. But I had the poem, and I had written it. It was pretty fresh, and I really needed to purge, and so I asked him to do the honors, and I was just blown away. That was the first take, I believe, Larry, is that correct? And you did a very good job, and he did exactly how I would have envisioned it. So I was very happy with it, and it's been with us and writing along with us for, I would imagine, over at least 16 years.
Well, you've known each other for that long, have you?
I don't know how long he was on MySpace. So I believe it goes back to about 98. Yeah, 1998.
Okay. So I think, we do have, I just checked the what we have, the archives here, and we do have the song on hand. I'm just going to hold off on actually playing it for just a few minutes, however. Regarding the lyrics and the inspiration, and either of you feel free to address this, but how exactly did it all come about? I know the lyrics, there's a lot about, Larry, maybe you can speak to this. Or, I'm sorry, you said Teresa, you wrote the lyrics? That's correct, I guess, is it?
Yes, the lyrics are mine. And they're very poetic. They're in verse form, which is very difficult for a musician to transfer over to music. There's a certain way to write if you're a lyricist, because I'm a lyricist as well.
Yes.
And then you write as a poet. And then there's mystic verse.
Right.
And that verse came to me as a gift. It helped me to purge through a very difficult time where fingers were being pointed, and no matter how the outcome would have presented itself, we were not going to survive it. Our names would not have been untarnished. There would have not been, what am I looking for here, an apology for having the pointed finger at us. And I immediately drew that up with the witches, the burning of the witches and the witch hunts. And that's exactly what they did. They would take the witches and on a pointed finger, just on somebody's pointed finger, they would take those people and to test them, they would tie them hand and foot, drop them into a deep lake. If they drowned, then they were deemed saints. If they came up for air, they were helped by Satan and pulled from the water and immediately tied to a pole and set afire. So you were damned if you did, damned if you didn't. Either way.
Exactly.
You were gonna-
Yeah, isn't that something? So it's so absurd, of course, and boggles the mind. It's what I call witch logic. I often refer to it in that sense. We find it occurring more often than what some people might recognize today as well, too, it seems. Just with the way that things are set up and run, often with the legal system or any number of other areas or situations. So that's maybe getting a little bit off track if we were to go down that rabbit hole. So, well, let's see now. So once again, the witches, long history, association, the character, and, the archetype or, prototype, what have you, of the witch featured throughout the history of Halloween, which is, I guess, it's referred to as, in Celtic tradition, Samhain. We don't really want to get into the Halloween thing too much right now, but if we could maybe talk about, because you do self-identify as a witch, and I'm not sure, I'm just not clear myself in what way exactly. There's a lot to be said, of course. Is one born a witch? Does one become a witch through initiation? The whole thing with Wicca, I believe, is it's a new phenomenon as well, too, if I'm not mistaken. But you were in a pre-interview, I remember the other day, you were telling us a little something about how, as a young girl, you had certain insights, or rather, I guess you would hear voices or be able to, it seemed, channel spirits of some sort. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit more about that, that would be the best place to take things right now.
I think that the very first thing that I became aware of, when I became self-aware that I was separate from mother and father and I was my own entity, was other entities that accompanied me everywhere. It was a little bit later when I got very angry with a little girl at school. I was about 10 years old, and I cursed her. I put a curse on a piece of paper. I don't know where I had the knowledge to do that. I just naturally did it. It was so natural to me. And the curse was that she would fall off her horse and break her leg, and I'll be damned if 2 days later she didn't fall off a horse and break her leg. I then knew that I had something, but I wasn't sure what it was called. It wasn't until later that I found out about the craft, about witchery. I did a little bit of research over the years, and what I've come to know is this. The original way of looking at witchcraft, you were looking at someone called a hedge witch. They didn't have covens back then. They were wise women and their families, and this was all handed down generationally. How to cure people of illnesses and how to help them with their misfortunes and things, and they would be on the hedge of the town where they would be close to the forest and have access to all of the things that they would need, the bark, the plant life, mushrooms, birds, animals, whatever they needed, they would have right there. And that's actually the beginning of witchery, the craft. And it was handed down from family to family member. I come from a long line of witches, but they are dowsing witches. And a dowsing witch is someone who finds water or wells. And as it turned out, there's a long line of us on my maternal side. I knew about my grandmother. I didn't know about all of the other women who came before her. So it made sense, to me as I got older and started finding out more things, that this came to me quite naturally. Later, I also found out that this is something that anyone could do. You don't have to be born a witch. You don't have to do anything special to be a witch other than to learn the craft. And to learn the craft, you have to start from the very beginning. You can't start in the middle. So if you're my age at 60, you're not going to learn the craft. You can kind of piddle with it if you'd like, but you need to be a little bit younger. Now, my grandchildren, right now I'm working with my 6-year-old, my 10-year-old, and my 14-year-old, who are very gifted, and they do get taught quite extensively on a craft.
Okay. I guess they've got a pretty good teacher then, someone who is obviously quite experienced and knowledgeable in what is known as the craft. Another angle here that just came to mind, what some people might be wondering themselves too, is Freemasonry is often, they refer to themselves as practitioners of the craft. Is there any connection there at all that you're aware of?
There's a connection with witchery or witchcraft or the craft, if you'd like, with all secret societies, including the Illuminati, the Rosicrucians, and, of course, the Masons. Back in the day, it would have been even the Cathars who were part of the and the Templars. So when you go back, even as far back as Constantine and when he changed over everything over from pagan to Christian, you were still having the craft performed or practiced in silence and in sequestered groups where it wasn't quite overt. It was more occult. And that's where we actually get that whole idea of occult, is that you don't know anything about it, so you immediately attribute that to something satanic or against the church, which is not the case.
Yeah, although it's hard, I guess it's hard to convince certain, you know, Christian fundamentalists of that. They've seemed to have things, they seem to be of a different persuasion and live in a lot of, I'm not sure what it is, fear perhaps, ignorance I guess too as well. And those two often seem to go hand in hand, the ignorance and the fear. So I'm just going to quickly check and see. We did have a lot of, yes, we do, activity there in the YouTube chat area. We've got Bathtub Jen, who's joined us, and Tyranny Unmasked. Yes, yes, Tyranny, we have, it looks like, apparently found a real witch for tonight's Halloween show. So we're really happy to have Teresa join us this evening. Let's see. Pirate Larry, I'm not sure we could bring you in just a second here, but a couple other points of discussion that I'd like to hit on. You live in St. Louis, and according to what you were sharing with us, is that it's one of the most haunted places in America. Maybe if you could just spend a moment or two kind of giving us more of a insight into the history and why that's the case. If we didn't lose. Oh, there we go.
When you, just because you're a witch doesn't know you how to work, you know how to work a computer.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, St. Louis is overwrought with all kinds of hauntings, and all around the area that would include East St. Louis in Illinois and some of the closer townships in Illinois. I think tonight they're actually doing a ghost hunt over there. One of the top 10 most haunted houses in the United States is the Limp Mansion, and we are the proud hosts of the Limp Brewery and the Limp Mansion, where I think there were 7 or 8 murders there and or suicides, and they all haunt the house.
That's LIMP. Is that how that's the limp, as in someone with a disability?
No, if you're going to look it up just to get some history on this, and this is quite fascinating, it's LEMP. Another, if I may be so bold, another one that might be of interest to your listeners is the fact that The Exorcist was done right here in St. Louis by the Jesuits. The hospital that it was done in has been razed, and they are now putting an elderly, an old folks home there, I guess, or a nursing home on that plot of land. But the church actually still stands, and so does the dorm behind it where some of the exorcisms were taking place.
The Exorcist movie starring Linda Blair is just what is what you're referring to, I guess. Is that right?
That's exactly it, except it was a little boy here. It wasn't a little girl. They changed the gender for the movie, and they keep his name very private. He's very protected. He's got to be about my age now.
Wow. So I see what you're saying now. So I thought you were talking about the movie itself. I had no idea that there was an actual case. I realize that there are these, you know, supposed exorcisms that have to occur, or that rather take place from time to time. They bring in the priests to deal with these, I guess, what are essentially demonic
spirits or these possessed people. But yeah, so if you could maybe just kind of fill us in a little more on this actual case study. But on top of that, in addition, let's not forget that there's been long been talk of how the movie itself, the movie set of The Exorcist was, and God, is that a scary movie or what? It's like, it's a little too real for my liking, but, it's well done, of course, and yeah. But that the set itself was, there were some really strange things that occurred on the set. Can you kind of talk about those two things a little bit, if you're able to?
I can talk a little bit on it. I don't want to take up too much time on The Exorcist, but everything that they depicted in the movie was pretty much exactly what happened, or exactly what was in the papers that were written, because they had to keep very good notes on this. The Vatican is very, they hesitate quite a bit before they allow an exorcist to go in.
Right.
So they could be proven that there is actually demonic possession. And they decided that this was a true case of demonic possession. So they sent a priest in, and he needed help. So he had a Jesuit go in with him. Mm-hmm. And the two of them experienced quite a few things. They were able to write down most of it. One actually did die as a result of that exorcism. The other one just passed away, I believe. Don't quote me on it, but I believe the other one had just passed away. So over the past, you know, years since that movie was made, every year they go back and revisit that. They would talk to the priest, who was at that point, I guess, able to give us a little bit more information on it. I'm not so sure that her head spun completely around, or that she lifted off the bed, but the writings on her stomach and that sort of thing did indeed happen. And she did speak in tongue, and she did reference one of the priest's mothers. So, yeah, it's interesting to research that, but that happened right here. And the church that happened with is called the University Church, which is part of Washington University here in St. Louis, just 20 minutes from me.
This story is amazing. I'm really kind of having my mind blown, actually, on this, because, once again, I had no idea that there was an actual case study, you know, that managed to inspire the movie. So, now, it was Malachi Martin, who I'm not sure if you followed Art Bell, his show over the years or not, but Malachi Martin, former Jesuit priest, now himself deceased, having passed away under rather mysterious circumstances, as well. Was he directly involved in this at all? Do you have any idea whether that was the case or not?
No, I'm going to tell you I don't know, because I don't know. But I will tell you this, that the set was fraught with all sorts of strange happenings. I don't recall each and every one of them. As a matter of fact, I don't recall any particular one at the moment. I wasn't prepared to give you information about The Exorcist. I'm sure that if you go and look this up, it'll give you all that information. And I want to point this out. When you're seeing something, or you're hearing something, or you're experiencing something, that be sentient or through smell or any of your senses, chances are the reason that it's getting such a huge response is because what you're experiencing is real, not fake. So if you were in a movie watching The Exorcist and didn't know that this actually happened, but you were having a very strong, sentient response to it, that's because probably deep down inside something was telling you this is a real story. This is more of a biography than just, you know, for entertainment.
Yeah, I think the word might be vicarious. Throw that out there, a vicarious experience, perhaps. So, and let's not forget as well, there's long been a lot of talk and allegations, theories regarding the curse surrounding the story of The Omen as well, the movie that was made back around that same era, back in the mid-1970s, basically, that there were certain, I guess, people associated with the movie that passed away under peculiar circumstances, and a lot of just very bizarre, strange, maybe a little too overly coincidental occurrences. So And just quickly, this priest that you mentioned, he passed away, the Jesuit, there was two priests you said went in and worked on dealing with the situation. The one passed away. How did that happen? It seems that you're maybe suggesting that it had something to do with his being there in the presence of this dark energy.
It was natural. He had his ages. I do want to point out that Poltergeist was fraught with a lot of death, a lot of accidents, a lot of things went awry when they were making Poltergeist.
Right.
Sometimes I think when we toy with things from the other side that we're not too familiar with, they can get out of hand. One example I think that you and I were talking about were djinn or demons. Mm-hmm. I have had the displeasure of having an experience with either of those. Everything I have experienced with is benevolent, but then I protect myself. However, you know, there are people out there who swear to it, and I'm not going to question them because that would be like questioning myself, you know, and I wouldn't want somebody to question me, so I take them at their word. And when you have experiences like this that are documented, especially on movie sets, you know, where people pass away, or I believe almost every one of the, I know the little girl that acted in the movie is now deceased.
Sure.
But they were all under really weird, you know, very weird kind of conditions. I think any time that you go in and you mess with the other side, not knowing what to expect, they know you don't know. And so those that would be playful or harmful or, you know, a little mischievous in a very negative way would take advantage of that. And that's why I think a lot of people are afraid of, like, Ouija boards.
Right.
For
you read my mind. I think we're on the same wavelength there right now with
Well, I have no fear of using a Ouija board. But then I'm protected. And I know what I'm doing when I'm using any kind of a tool, mm-hmm. a saying tool. So I'm not afraid to use it. And I know what to look for. I know how to be very careful, and I know how to protect myself. I've been doing it for quite a long time. And like I said, I've never had any experience with anything malevolent. There have been many, many reports of people who say that they've had very, very bad experiences with. I do want to pass this on to the listener that there's not anything different than a Ouija board or the use of a pendulum. So if you use a pendulum and where you're asking yes and no questions and it circles for maybe or any of that sort of thing, it's the equivalent of a Ouija board. So you have to be careful when you pick up tools of the metaphysical genre because the misusing of it is so easy. A mispronunciation of a word could mean the difference between getting what you want and getting something you really don't want. So you have to be very, very careful.
Well, and we've got Bathtub Jen actually chiming in here from the sidelines here in the YouTube chat area regarding divining and scrying, curiouser and curiouser is what she comments. So in addition to where we're at this particular moment, two things. One, how exactly do you protect yourself? And secondly, I believe as the story goes regarding magical items and implements and so forth, that it is not a good idea generally to bring on board older items or perhaps things that have been in another person's possession at some particular point in time, like that you've maybe picked up at a local pawn shop or something like that. You've got to really look out for that. Is that not the case? You've got to be careful with that sort of thing.
Very true. Not only are a house is haunted, my backyard could be haunted, and the things that I carry with me can carry hauntings. If you want to call, I'm just using that word because it's something I think everybody can relate to. And what I mean by hauntings is that they possess energies that can come across and take on their own, you know, their own personality. They can override yours. So it's overriding your power as well. Now, in order, you ask me how I protect myself. First of all, I have within the interdimensional beings, which are called my others, they do a great deal of the protection. I was born with them. That's another subject. But the other thing that I always do before I do any kind of divination at all is I smudge myself thoroughly, smudge the room thoroughly, smudge the objects I'm going to be using thoroughly, and then I do a whole ritual, which includes, as a final act, the salting of a circle. But you could use flour as well, and you can use ground up brick. So there are several different kinds of compounds that you can use for protection. The idea is to have that circle protected, never to step out of the circle while you're in divination, and until you've closed it. And right. Once you close the door, then you can leave and you can open up that that circle. But you're only safe while you're inside of it. The other thing I want to tell you is that you're always in control, because we're human and this is our realm. We're in control of what's on this side. So if we encounter a spirit that misbehaves a little, we can tell it to leave. It has to leave. So we can rescind its invitation in. We can close the door on them. They have to obey, because we own this realm. Now, in their realm, they own it. So that's the difference, is that when we cross over, we want to cross over and play in their realm, they've got all the power.
All right. Pirate Larry, I guess you've been kind of on, you've been pretty quiet there for the last little while. Do you have any, want to kind of help maybe bring things up to speed, or anything that you'd like to add to the conversation?
Well, I think this is great. You know, I mean, Halloween is about ghosts, and it's about, you know, talking to the dead. Many, many, many cultures tell us that the dead have not left us. And yet, you know, I think the Age of Reason and the church tried to suppress that idea. There was heaven and hell, and, you know, people went to heaven and went to hell. But there are many, many cultures that say that the dead haven't left us. Right?
Indeed, yes, exactly. Well, that's one of the things, you're based out of Ensenada, down in Baja, of course. So how do Mexicans, is it not the Day of the Dead, or how do they celebrate or mark Halloween exactly?
Not exactly Halloween. I mean, they've imported Halloween down here, but they have Dia de los Muertos. It's on a different day. And that's the Day of the Dead, and there are parades. You know, costumes, lots of skulls. But basically, you know, you have something in your house that is where you keep your pictures of your grandparents and, you know, those who have passed away. And you know, you bring flowers and you may burn incense, offer a cup of tequila, you know, a little shot of tequila or Jack Daniels, whatever. Cakes, sweets,
sure,
that kind of thing.
Very similar in Korea, actually, with ancestral worship. Visiting the tombs and the grave sites several times usually each year, marking the deceased relative's birthday or what have you. So I think they might do it during the new year as well too. It all kind of just really depends. But okay, well, we definitely wanted to get that out there.
Well, you might add just a little something to this before we move on.
By all means. Go ahead. Yes, of course.
Is that people say this is the time of the thinning of the veil.
Right.
The thinning of the veil happens on and off in a cyclical manner. And exactly, Pirate Larry just explained it perfectly. When they have their Day of the Dead, their veil is thin. It's not just thin for them. It's thin for everybody. So there are always times going on when the veil does become thinner. Back in the olden days, and the reason that we worry so much about Halloween is and that veil thinning is this. The 31st, which is All Hallows Eve, or those who are holy, is last day of the Celtic year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the beginning of hell for them, because they have to survive harsh winters. They have huge bonfires. They light their own fires and their own hearths by that fire. If that fire goes out, it could mean life or death to them. So on that day, they feel that the dead come out. It's the last day of the year. The dead come out, and that's when they're going to decide who is going to leave that year and who are going to stay. And they even at some point thought that you could actually be pulled to the other side while you were still human, in human form. So it's very interesting when you look at all of this, all of the fear that goes into it. It's all mythology. You know, it's all of I've got to have an answer for what's going on. But these people had a real reason to fear their winter. They had a hard time getting through their winters.
There was a famous Greek musician. I think they built there was a religion that was formed around him, too, going to the underworld, down to Hades, and to retrieve his deceased wife, Eurydice. And his name escapes me if you can believe that. So
her name is Persephone.
Well, no, but the musician's name, Orpheus. There we go. It's called the Orphic cults. So Orpheus from ancient Greece. That he was allowed to visit Hades in human form, provided that he did, and he would be able to retrieve his wife, so long as he didn't look back. You know, the love bond there was so strong that he just would go to any length to have her return with him. But unfortunately, he looked back, and I think he was not able to bring her back to the world of the living. So a couple more comments here coming in from the sidelines. Bathtub Jen, just to kind of back things up here from the way things have been unfolding, is that she says she wants to hear us talk about necromancy for creative purposes, which I suppose would be like marijuana for medical purposes. I think one of the things she might be getting at there, though, too, is the way that perhaps things like weed are used on a spiritual level, and how our spiritual being and it kind of shifts, it changes, does it not, when we imbibe, shall we say, or I'm not sure if the word is induce or not, but when we use drugs, essentially alcohol too, let's not forget consuming these spirits, alcohol, you know, beer, whiskey, tequila, whatever. I think there's a reason that they're called spirits.
Are you asking a question?
I'm trying to kind of set things up there and get around to putting the question out there to you. So, but mostly she wanted to know about how perhaps that tied into this business of necromancy, which I guess the euphemistic term that you provided us with the other day, just so as not to hopefully scare away too many listeners, was medium. So, but if you could kind of tie that all together, if it's possible, just with drug use and or alcohol and channeling of spirits and so forth.
Anytime that you alter the mind, and the mind becomes more open, and that's the key word, is open. This is something that Timothy Leary talked about in our day. Those that are younger than us will have to look up Timothy Leary now, but he was a big proponent of LSD. So people who do psilocybin, people who drink ayahuasca, people who just smoke some really good pot, you know, or sometimes even imbibing in alcohol, if it relaxes you enough and empties your mind, or at least distracts your mind enough that you're not focusing on any one particular thought, your mind is open to be contacted. The dead on the other side want to speak to us. They want to do it. But the only way they can do that is telepathically. They have no mouth. They have no ears. So they have to do it through mind, which is frequency and vibration. They come to us in that form. And if we're thinking too hard on other things and we're too busy with our thoughts, then we can't possibly hear them. They'll even try to put thoughts into our mind to speak out of our own mouths. And I know there are a lot of people out there who've wondered, wow, where did that come from? Well, it's coming from another entity who wants you to hear it. So pay attention to it. I am really a proponent of meditation as well. That's another way that you can open your mind and learn how to empty it so that you can speak to the dead. Anybody can be a necromancer. Anybody can be a medium. It's just a matter of getting control of your mind. Now, these other things are very helpful. I have a little bit of an issue with being more creative as a necromancer. I don't know that you would be more creative. But I will tell you this. My others dictated basically the mystic verses to me, and I put it into verse. So the book is dedicated to them, and I actually give them credit for writing the book. They simply used me, and as Larry has always called me, I am a catalyst. So with that information and the person who is asking, of course they can influence you creatively. You might see yourself painting a cat, and then all of a sudden it goes dark or it goes weird or something, and it might be that something else is informing you. And that's just fine. You don't have to protect yourself from that. It's a benevolent person, probably someone you know on the other side who is actually guiding your hand. I get woke up in the middle of the night to come out here and write, and half the time I don't even know I'm out here doing it.
You apparently also are signing your books. I'm not sure if it's just the mystic verses or not, but you have been signing your books in blood. No one can argue you're not taking your work seriously, so that's pretty hardcore.
By request, you have to order the books for me directly. It's $30 for the books, but that includes everything, shipping, handling, and everything else. I sign the books exactly as you'd want them signed and dedicate them to whomever you want them dedicated to. And then you also get a notarized copy of authentication that it's my signature and it's my blood, and I also give you my blood type. So this is something you would want to keep if you were a somebody who likes to collect things and then sell them later. As a matter of fact, right now I've got somebody selling my book for $80 on eBay, which is driving me crazy. But an interesting thing, there are people out there who really get off on this, who really appreciate this. This is a big come-to thing for people that if I can sign it in blood, they'll buy the book. It's the make or break the deal kind of thing. And I don't mind doing it. I give my blood for my rites and my rituals too. So I'm constantly sticking myself with things. So,
yeah, I'm not sure how many other authors actually do that, but it's definitely quite the novel approach. Very, very intense once again. So,
yes, and it is only mystic verses that I do that with.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That was one of the things I wanted clarified. So, and we're actually going to be, we're planning on ending the show with a recitation of your mystic verse poem, The Witch's Lust. Is that from the mystic verses compilation, or is that a separate publication that comes from?
Witch's Lust is a mystic verse. I didn't write it. They inspired it. And I just put it into verse form. Witch's Lust will be in Mystic Verses 2, which everybody right now is biting at the bit for me to get out, but I'm getting married soon, so it's going to have to wait. But Mystic Verses 2 will be coming out, and Witch's Lust is one of the verses that will be in there. The thing about mystic verse, and I do want to preface it just quickly, is that you have to read it 3 or 4 times before you really start to understand it. It's all symbolic in its wording. It's like the Bible and Jesus talking in parables or, you know, that sort of thing. So it's not real easy to comprehend at first. I know people who keep it at their bedside and will just open it up to a page to see what it says to them, thinking that just that opening it up is going to be a reference to something going on in their life, you know. However you want to read it is fine. But I find that the more I read my book, the more I understand the mystic verses logic and the message behind the words and the symbols used. So even I, who am the author, I guess, because you can't talk to my others at the moment. But even as the author, there are days when I look at something I've written and I go, oh, damn, I think I just figured that out. So there you have it. And be my guest, player, you know, Witch's Lust.
yeah, once again, I think that's how we're going to wrap things up here today with the feature front end of the show. And then, of course, as is typically the case, transition on into the back end of today's production, the Rogues Gallery segment. So hopefully you'll be able to join us there if you still have enough juice in your batteries when we draw close to the front end here. So once again, more comments coming in from the sidelines here.
I'll stay as long as you want me to stay, and I'll answer every one of your questions. Just hang in there.
Okay, and I will tell you that things do open up a little more in the Rogues Gallery. Typically, we have people that do join us for a discussion and just a more free-flowing kind of approach to things. So I imagine, though, with you being, as is the case, today's special guest, that you're probably going to get, you've hit up for a few questions from listeners that join us behind the scenes. So one of the things that Tyranny Unmasked here is asking in the text chat off of the streaming YouTube channel that we have running here is that he's interested in knowing your definition of spirits, demons, angels, etc. And there are angels too, of course. Yes, more like protector. Everyone has these protective energies or beings that are a part of their lives.
I don't believe in a God, and I don't believe in Satan. I do believe in Lucifer. I believe that he is a good angel. I don't believe in the negative. I have a husband who passed away who has told me everything there is to know about the other side. There is no, quote, heaven, nor hell, nor judgment. I will say that there are, however, angels. Now, that gets into another subject on another day about aliens, because actually our watchers are angels. They're Nephilim, but they were cast out for having sex and lusting after earthly women. We also have good spirits. Spirits are actually, if you could just imagine for a moment, that we're all made of water, and water takes on three different forms: solid, gaseous, and liquid form. We're always in one of those forms. So when we're gaseous, when that gas form, that mist form, that ethereal form, we're spirit, and we'll come back in another form on another day. Spirits per se are not dangerous and are not malevolent at all. I have not ever come across a malevolent spirit or demon, as they call them. So I'm not really all that familiar with demonic entities. I refuse to have anything to do with demonic entities. And perhaps maybe that's why. Maybe it's because they know they can't. But I do understand that there are people who qualify that for you.
In what sense exactly?
I do know people who do go out and they're ghost hunters. They're actually bona fide ghost hunters. And they're here in Missouri. We do have our own ghost hunters who go about looking around and checking things out. And they've come across some very malevolent spirits, so which would be categorized as demonic. Anything that's not benevolent is demonic. So they've had their own experiences with that. I haven't been with them. I've been invited to go. I haven't been able to go yet, but I would like to go because I'd like to communicate with them and find out exactly why they're so malevolent. So I might play with that a little bit, but I'd have to really bone up on it first, you know, become more familiar. But I'm not one to say that I know that much about the demonic aspects because I don't have much to do with them.
Would you not agree that we are all, in fact, possessed?
I think that we all have both malevolent and benevolent sides. It's a duality that exists. I think that when we're in spirit form, that duality also exists. I think that there are, I know that there are spirits who refuse to go through the veil and want to stay right here in this realm, but can't stay here because they're no longer alive. They no longer have a body to travel in, but they refuse to let go. They tend to be the ones who give you the trouble. They don't want you in their homes. They don't want you to possess their things. They become very frustrated and over time become even more malevolent. I believe that's really where the demonic part of it comes from, are those entities, those people who pass on and just refuse to go through the veil. And the veil, by the way, if you hold your hand up in front of your face and just blow into it, that's how close the veil is to you. That's how close the veil is to all of us. We could blow into the palm of our hand, and we've blown through the veil.
How about that? So one of the reason I asked you whether or not we are all, in fact, possessed is because I often go back to the ancient Greek word. I believe it's Koine Greek. It was, you know, during the time of people like Socrates and even up, you know, during the time of Christ, even, I'm sure, it was very commonly understood that the word eudaimonia was the term. And essentially what that meant was simply the good demon within. You know, you got the eu, the prefix, euthanasia, euphoria. Anyways, the prefix meaning good, and then demon, eudaimonia, within. But yeah, it just, all that meant was happiness. Was you know, that was it. So I guess in a sense of our, and if you look at the word, like with saints, for example, they've got their spiritual house in order. It's kind of all been swept out, maybe with that witch's broom. Sometimes, you know, that's the same kind of deal there. I would imagine that's partly what that's used for, is to clean the space. So
that's called besom. The word for that is besom.
Come again?
A witch's broom is called a besom.
Oh.
It's between a broom and a besom.
And how do you spell that? It's a B-E-S-S-E-M? B-E-S-S-U-M?
B-E-S-O-M.
B-E-S-O-M, besom. Well, how about that? That's quite something. So, but is that not correct that it's, you know, we, with the spiritual space we have within, that needs to be clean, but also that's why the practitioners of, well, the craft, I guess, is what you reference it as. So, that's why they use the brooms, is not only just to sweep the dust and dirt and whatnot, but also as a form of meditation, I suppose, in a spiritual sense where the space is, purified and cleansed.
I think it's more of a metaphor. I don't think that you can just sweep away bad things from yourself. I think it takes quite a bit more effort than just being able to sweep it away. And one of the things is recognizing that we do have a darker side to ourselves. And we always want to get rid of the darker sides of ourselves. We need those darker sides of ourselves. That's helps us survive in this body that we possess. I believe that what you're going towards is almost hermetics, which is a whole nother show as well, which I'd love to talk to you about hermetics. But, you know, he says, "What as above, so below, as without, so within." And that is so true. There is nothing that we aren't a part of, or that isn't a part of us.
Right.
We are pieces of a whole, and we come together as one. So whether we're dead or alive, we're all pieces of the same whole.
Joe 333 just joined us now, coming on board, a regular member of the Pirate Radio podcast crew. Good to see you, Joe. Thanks for being a part of things. And Alchemy Doll, Suzanne Isles, I believe is her name. Hopefully she'll be joining us for the after show. I think you and her would hopefully be able to hit it off on a number of levels. So, we'll see about that. Yeah, great fall day in Korea, Joe. You're right. It's quite beautiful. So just, backing things up here a little bit. We got once again a lot of activity here from listeners and people that are viewing the slideshow that we're streaming here. So, but talking about, I think it was Tyranny Unmasked, stating that you were dealing with beings of the ether. So I'm not sure if you can really address that one or not. I have no idea what that means, frankly, but I guess that would go back to what you were talking about when you referenced, was it the others? Is that correct?
Correct. And of course, when I referenced the water, metaphor of what we are. So we should never fear death. Death doesn't really exist. We just take on another form. And we get quite comfortable very quickly over there, as a matter of fact. And if you, anybody out there is really interested in any more reading for that, I'll cite this source, and I'll cite all my sources for you tonight, later on, at the bottom of this cast, I guess, where you make your comments. But, there's a book called, Billy Fingers, and it's very interesting. Billy Fingers made it, you know, talked his sister into writing a book with him. And it's exactly verbatim everything that my husband told me. So it was a huge affirmation for me. So now I have absolutely no question whatsoever that anything that I heard Jim say to me wasn't the absolute truth. He is still with me today, but I know that he will be traveling on soon. He didn't say when, but he said soon that they move on to another level. So there are levels on the other side of the veil. Your question, however, about the ethereal, there is the physical, and then there is the ethereal. That's that space around us, that's constantly around us. And inside of the ethereal exists many, many types of entities. One of those entities would be a loved one who's passed away. Another one might be angelic, an angelic source. Saints, I'll tell you, I've got a problem with the word saint. I'll take that up with you another time. But anything that's ethereal is accessible to us. We just have to know the correct way to do that. And I do teach this. I actually do teach this in my home. I take up to 6 people at a time in a metaphysics class for free. And I teach them exactly what it is I do so that they can do it for themselves.
That's one thing that you were telling us in the pre-interview the other day, is that unlike other people that, you know, call themselves mediums or channelers or what have you, that you don't charge anything for helping people.
Yeah, I teach meditation for free as well in my home. So I do it all for free because it's a gift to me. If it's gift to me, it should be gift to you. Actually, you're born knowing. Everybody's born with this power, with all of the things that I'm telling you I possess. And then some. There are things that I don't even know I possess because I haven't gone there yet. The problem is it's taught out of us quite early by well-meaning parents and teachers and other adults who've fallen under the spell of dogma. It's a shame that they have done that, because a lot of times we lose our connection to what we already know, to that thing called Akashic knowledge, which is that real knowledge. All of our thoughts and all of our experiences go into that Akashic knowledge, and it's there for the teaching. It's there for the, all you have to do is reach up and ask the question and the answer comes to you. It's that easy. If you only knew, that's all I can say.
Ask and you shall receive.
There's a lot of things in the Bible, because Jesus was a very, very, he was a mystic, you know. He was a very smart man. He was first a Jew and then a rabbi, and also very mystic because he looked further for the truth.
Yeah, and my take on that whole, with old, you know, JC, was that he was probably one of the first Bujus, or is it Jubus? How do they call it? Jubus, I think, something like that. So Jewish Buddhists, because and that goes back, just what I've kind of researched, that the connection with India and the missing years, of course. And that's, you know, he returned back to Palestine, and he had these strange foreign teachings talking about love and compassion. And I and the Father are one. Well, there's your non-duality. That it's all connected, you know. It's like I and the Father are one. Yeah, you know what? You are too, and then so is Larry, and so are my cats, and everything. It's inseparable. We're born out of the singularity, I guess. Is people these days, they talk about imposing this post-humanist, transhumanist, you know, technologically based singularity with microchips, the implants, and who knows what, virtual reality. But no, it's, to me at least, it seems we are born out of it. There's no escape in it. And there's, you know, there's no need to adopt some artificial model either, frankly, because that's just totally, you know, just, it's false, of course. So
it's all that mythology that we as human beings have to have an answer to everything. So if my house apart and leaves the house standing next door, I must have done something really bad to piss God off. But the people next door were very godly, and so he saved them. You know, there has to be answers to questions, but because if we don't have answers, we become very fearful and afraid. We can't accept the answer that it just is. And that's a shame, because that we hold on so tightly to those dogmas, to those mythologies. Joseph Campbell was really big on exposing mythologies, but also saying how very valuable they are in our lives, because most of us really wouldn't know how to behave or how to even assimilate in society without our mythologies. So we have to have those to a degree. But they change. Whatever the common belief is, that's our truth. That's what becomes our truth, is whatever the common people believe, majority believe, that is the truth, whether or not it really is or not.
The consensual view of reality, or, yeah, consensual truth, I guess, is what some people refer to it as. You're saying it just is, just kind of let it go and accept. I think if I'm following what you're getting at here, just, you know, let it go, let it be, just accept it for what it is and that it just is. But what if things like reincarnation and karma?
Karma doesn't happen in the same life you're living. So this is my belief, okay? And I can cite sources, but it would take more of your time here. Karma happens to you in consecutive lives. So your karma might not catch up with you for another life or two. But karma does come to you because our lives are here to teach us things. We become human to learn. However, here's the real irony to this, is our eyes can't even see the whole spectrum of colors that are out there. Our ears cannot pick up the whole spectrum of sounds that are out there.
Right.
Our senses are so dulled compared to the senses of animals that are considered lesser than we are. And that's taste, that's smell, that's all of it. So we think we're so superior, and we're really not. We're all sentient, but we're all sentient at different levels. Now, the more you open up to what I call spiritualism, because it doesn't belong to any one particular dogma. It's your journey, not my journey. It's your journey to your truth. You find it, and you keep moving on. Don't ever stop asking the question. The minute you stop asking the question will be the day that you probably lose the answer that is your salvation, and that's one of my quotes. So I would say that with every question, it should also cause you to ask two more. And it should expand exponentially that way, so that you're constantly asking questions. I can't tell you all of the different sciences that I am now involved in. Hermeticisms, gnosis, quantum physics, quantum mechanics. You know, and all of the different belief systems, the religions, the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, Buddhists, Taoism, Christianity. I'm actually a bona fide certified catechist, so I have a broad knowledge of theology, but an even broader knowledge of theosophy. So there's all of these different sciences, all of these different ways of looking at the world. There's so much more to the truth than what you see right in front of you. So if you meet someone, like, for instance, my fiancé does not believe in ghosts. He does not believe in anything. I believe it's because it frightens the shit out of him. But the thing is, he just absolutely across the board refuses to believe in it. But he doesn't say it's hogwash, you shouldn't believe in it. My husband used to say the same thing until he started seeing it with his own eyes. I've had people I rent rooms to here who have seen it with their own eyes or have been touched by entities. It's all been a journey for me to watch other people come into my house and give me affirmation that it's not just me seeing this stuff or experiencing these things, that other people have too. My husband died a believer, and that's why he came back and talked to me. But we had an agreement that whoever died first would come back
right
and tell the what's on the other side. He did his job.
And you know, when you say believer, what exactly do you mean by that?
There are people who just really think that everything metaphysical is hogwash. However, science is starting to really embrace it. It's actually a higher science. It's more of an experiential type of science where you have to experience it, see it, feel it, you know, have some kind of contact with it to actually start believing in it. You develop your theories and then you start to, you know, work on that to prove it or disprove it. Quantum mechanics is right now showing us that telepathy really does exist. They're on the verge of making a couple of other announcements. This is quantum mechanics that also give credence to metaphysics science. Now, every time they do that, it just increases the authenticity of metaphysics, which is fine with me because I think it'd be wonderful if the world could return to a time like the time of the Celts where they believed more in nature as their church, that trees are sentient, that plants are sentient, rocks are sentient, the ground is sentient, the air is sentient. There isn't a single thing in our surroundings that isn't part of the whole one.
Absolutely, yeah. So that would be, I guess, what some might refer to, you know, in the modern day and age as Gaia, I guess. The gentleman who founded that term, or coined that term, I believe, his name was Lovelock. But rather than steering off in that direction, there's a few more comments. Once again, we need to catch up to speed on this. Just if you could perhaps share with us something in response to what people are... Well, this thing, for example, Bathtub Jen, she says, if I become a catalyst and some ghost writes a book through me, I still get the royalties and pass those on to the descendants, right? With the right attorney, of course. So she's making a joke. Yeah, I think she's making a bit of a joke there. So she was quite impressed, too, that you sign your books in your own blood. Let's see what else we've got here. Regarding the royalties, what if I'm the ghost that's writing through me?
You're asking if you can be both ghost and human?
Well, here's the thing. I think what she's talking about is after she dies, if she channels herself or she comes through someone's maybe such as yourself or another medium and, you know, how that all kind of plays out. So
she won't be paid for royalties where she's at.
She wants as a ghost, she wants to be paid for royalties. So Lady Gaga is Agag backwards. Yeah, Joe. Just as Islam is, if you break it down, is I-slam. So there is a bit of that going on these days in the world, it seems, definitely with a lot of the slamming and so forth. So
Every single religion known to man on Earth today has a mystic branch off of it.
Oh, the Sufis.
Exactly. Sufis is one example of Islam. There's also, in the Catholic faith, there's the Opus Dei and a few others. In the Judaism, there is the Kabbalah. But it's like they say, you're not going to understand it until your mind is prepared. So to give you this information, it's like taking a 10-year-old into a college course in geometry. They're not going to get it. They have to go through the stages to get to that level of understanding. And that's why I think some people really just reject it, is because they don't want to just admit that they don't know. I don't have a problem telling you I don't know. If it's not something I'm familiar with, I'll be the first one to tell you I have no idea. But I will know something about it by the end of the day because I'll research it.
That's in line very much with any time a Zen master, a true Zen master, typically when they're approached and asked what is enlightenment, they respond by stating simply, I don't know. I don't know. So.
But I think it's different for everybody. Everybody's experience is different. Your journey is different. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe it's Hess that wrote Siddhartha.
Yes.
wonderful book about a journey. He goes out to meet the Buddha and then completely abandons the whole idea of meeting the Buddha. He actually meets with the Buddha. He crosses paths with the Buddha. The journey he is on is to find out who he is and what his life is about and what is important about life. There are so many lessons he learns on his journey. I had to read the book several times. I found it that informative that I read it several times. But I'm a Hermann Hesse fan anyway.
Yeah, he was very, was it Damien was another book of his, The Glass Bead Game and so forth. So some more comments here coming in from what we have streaming on YouTube. Tyranny says, I love hearing other people's viewpoints of the same thing I have dealt with. Suzanne, a.k.a. Alchemy Doll over on Minds.com. We aren't a body with a spirit, but a spirit wearing a body. I think that's partly what, and indeed what, Teresa has laid out for us here.
They're separate. They're actually separate. They're not melded together. And that's the one thing that I want to caution people about, is like the brain and the mind are not the same thing. There's the mind and then there's the brain. There's the body and then there's the spirit. And they work in tandem with one another. So your brain needs information and your mind actually supplies information to it. And it comes from, actually, the ethereal. And it goes out and grabs it from consciousness, which is the consciousness, what other people would call the God particle, the God-like creator, the source, and brings it back and puts it to where the brain can make use of it. And then the brain speaks to the mind. I mean, it communicates with the mind through the synapses. The same thing happens with the body. When the body dies, the soul does not abandon the body immediately. It takes up to sometimes 3 or 4 hours for the soul to actually completely leave body. And I think that's something that quantum physics has proven. I encourage you to stay with your beloved, your beloved deceased up to 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours, till they've made their crossing over, which I think is a wonderful thing. Why would they separate? You know, the soul really wants to stay connected to that body. And I believe that, you know, well, I don't believe, I'm going to tell you what Jim told me, was that he had to go through a mourning phase. When he walked through the veil, he didn't know where he was, but then he was met with, by loved ones. But he had to go through a mourning phase of his own because he had lost his senses. And he was aware that he no longer could do the things that he once could do in a physical body. And that was quite a shock for him. So you can imagine, you know, if you, when you die and you move on, you go through the veil and you realize there's no body, I have no reflection, you have to acclimate, you have to assimilate into your environment over there. I think Larry speaks really well to this subject with the Hinduists, because the Hindi actually have some very profound logic on the whole idea of spirituality and how it connects to the actual physical body.
Okay, well, maybe now is a good time then to hear from Larry once again. We're almost at the bottom of the hour. I'm not sure how much, we don't want to probably carry on too much further past that, although it would be great to hear just a little bit more about Halloween before we wrap things up. Just a couple gems, if you can pull those out of your magical cloak, as it were. So,
and I also want to, I don't want to lose whoever is online right now who is related, who has someone on the other side by the name of, now I might not be hearing it correctly, Adeline or Adelaide. I'm hearing Ada. Addie maybe was a name that they were called in life. So if you are still out there, hang on, because I believe that's who I'm speaking with right now, is and that's the only one right now who's present, and wants to talk for some reason. So if you'll wait till the after show, I'll talk to whoever knows Adeline, Addie, Adelaide, whatever.
Well, how about okay. That? Yeah, we do have a handful of people that are tuning in with us live for today's show, which is that's great, of course. So, but yeah, Pirate Larry, just if you would respond to what Teresa was referencing.
Okay, I'm going to try to make this quick.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
So you have Akashic space, right? Which is where all the spiritual happens, you know? Spirituality happens in a space. It has to have space in order to happen. It has to have space and time. Even if it's eternal, there has to be time or it doesn't happen. So, but in the physical world, physical things happen. Now, let's take this back to physics. The physicist will tell you that electrons exist as waves until they're observed, and then they turn into particles. So then, you know, physics right now, it only sees, there are two types of physics. One, they only see the particles. They only see the matter. There's another branch of physics that's saying, wait a minute, it's all waves. It must have something to do with gravity. It must have something to do, you know, and it does. It has a lot to do with electromagnetics, which, you know, people can get into later. But however we try to control the Akashic world, really, the spiritual world is in control. You know, it's beyond attack. So
it's also said that, try as we might, no one is ever able to outrun their karma, and that it follows us like a shadow. You know, so... for whatever that's worth, but thanks, appreciate that, Larry. What also another question here from the sidelines is what are your thoughts, Teresa, on the pineal gland, aka the third eye? I think we're kind of in that area right now of discussion. So
thanks, whoever asked about that. We're destroying our pineal gland, and it's a third eye. It sits right. If you were to put your finger where just above your eyebrows and push back, it would actually come down. It would come out the back of your skull down lower towards the base of your skull before it goes into your spinal column. And right down in the middle of that is a little pine cone looking thing called a pineal gland. And this gland is responsible for that communication, that vital communication with the Akashic. If we lose it, and we lose it by drinking fluoride, by having fluoride, you know, and eating all the crap, and, you know, there's a lot of things that can actually make it shrink up and just die. We're going to kill it. You can, however, regenerate it if it hasn't been completely destroyed. And the more you regenerate it, and you can do that through meditation, by the way, you regenerate your pineal gland, the more your third eye will start to speak to you again. When it speaks to you, you're going to be, it's going to feel like intuitiveness, intuition. And it's supposed to feel like that because there isn't a single animal on this earth that does not survive by its instinct except humans. Human beings will not listen to their instincts. They don't believe in themselves. They don't believe in what they're hearing or what they know. They have to have something else out there, and I'm one of them. I'm just as human as anybody else. I like my affirmations. So those affirmations are important because every time you get an affirmation, it makes you more, it gives you more confidence in what you already know. The pineal gland was given to us for one reason and one reason only, and that is for us to be able to use that instinct to survive. And we're slowly losing it. And that's a shame.
Well, I think, in fact, there are some people that have speculated that it's not by accident that that is occurring. And that, in fact, the powers that be are very much aware of the power of the pineal gland. And that they've done everything within that they've been able to this point, as you say, through with the food supply, GMOs and all the additives and chemicals, the fluoride in the water, which is said to calcify, I believe is the claim, calcify the pineal gland. And, you know, so it's done, and who knows what vaccines are doing exactly, but there's a lot that, you know, people talk about as far as that's concerned as well, too, of course. But yeah, so it is, that is one of the, you know, the claims and allegations that it's being done quite consciously, to destroy or suppress, weaken, and ultimately eliminate that because of what the power that it does, that it does contain.
Here's what you lose when you lose your pineal gland. You lose your dream state. You lose your ability to be lucid in your dreams, remote viewing, astral projection, a host of things that you can do with the mind while it's asleep or while it's in a meditative state. It's photosensitive. So when it's exposed to light, it actually picks up light. Though it is not an eye, it's not connected to our two eyes, but it does acknowledge light. Now that's been proven, so that's a fact. There are quite a few things that we need the pineal gland for. It picks up on electromagnetics as well. It informs us on a spiritual level. When we're asleep, we're no longer ruled by the body. The soul actually sort of takes over. Our body goes into a state of like a rigor mortis. You know, we're unable to move, and there's a reason for that as well. When you take things like DMTs or LSDs or anything that is psychotropic, the ayahuasca, anything like that, you're actually stimulating your pineal gland. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and take LSD, but, you know, if you feel the need to expand your mind, I'm all for it because I'm a fan of Timothy Leary's philosophy, so.
Yeah, and things like mushrooms, psilocybin, and as you mentioned, ayahuasca, these things are, I believe, you know, quite clearly they're put on, and weed, of course, too. You're looking at Genesis 1, even as the green herb, have I given you all things as meat, that they're gifts of creation, and that for them to be prohibited, and for certain, you know, for this war to be waged literally against plants and things that are organic and of the earth is, it's beyond comprehension. It's completely inexcusable, and ultimately qualifies really as these what has long been committed are crimes against humanity, especially if you consider the death toll that has arisen because the suppression of these vital medicines, weed in particular, which has now been shown to be able to help to cure cancer. You know, so really this, you know, a little bit off here on a bit of a rant, but very much in favor of truth and reconciliation hearings, and seeing that you know, that certain people are held accountable.
They don't want us to have freedom of mind. We're supposed to be sheeple. We're supposed to get up in the morning, do the same thing, come home, do the same thing, and do it all again tomorrow. And this is the way our life is supposed to be run. And we're taught that very early on. You get your education or you learn a trade, and then you get your butt out there and you work until you're too old to really to learn any of this, to even have, why even bother? Just go to your desk and, you know, make room for another soul. Because what they want really are worker bees. And what most of us are worker bees. But when you lose your pineal gland, you lose your self-realization, your self-awareness, your intuition, your consciousness, your everything that is part of that ethereal thinking is completely depleted. You're unable to see yourself as singular, as unique, as something other than the person sitting next to you. How many people out there, raise your hands if you're listening, how many people out there go to lunch and pay and even remember one face they saw in the restaurant while they were ordering their food, including the people who served them? You are being taught not to see them, not to acknowledge them, not to become a part of them. We're being taught even more so with technology to disengage, completely disengage. And when we do that, they finally succeed at doing that. They have silenced us.
Indeed. So we've kind of messed up a little bit here with the production of today's show, not in a major way, but just in the sense that we had promised to play the song that you and Pirate Larry had collaborated on, which I believe is called Witch. I think we're going to do that now. I know things are kind of winding down, and we're going to be wrapping up here in a little bit, but let's play that song and let's come back into things. And we can have a little bit more of a discussion as we draw things to a close, talk a little bit more about Halloween, and then close things off with your recitation of The Witch's Lust. So let's give that a listen now. The song that Pirate Larry did with Teresa called Witch.
Beneath the murky water lies proof of innocence misused. Silence beneath the hallowed veil, embodied in cries of those accused. Witch proclaimed the righteous ones. Oh, how the words do linger. No other cause to curse her with, but on their pointed finger. Aside her waist, they bound her wrists and bound her foot and knee. They muffled her and blinded her. Truth could not speak or see. They issued judgment on the shore, then bowed their heads in prayer. They tossed her into the icy depths, awaiting justice there. Witch proclaimed the righteous ones. Oh, how the words do linger. No other cause to curse her with, but on their pointed finger. Should the witch survive the test and surface with her breath, surely saved by Satan's hand, would then be condemned to death. Bound again upon the stake, put ablaze upon the fire. Her scream was quickly muffled and consumed within the fire. Witch proclaimed the righteous ones. Oh, how the words do linger. No other cause to curse her with, but on their pointed finger. But has she surfaced, the waters break and never registered her complaint. She would sink into the water's depths. Judge not a witch, but a saint. The story has no purpose but to stifle the pointed finger. The voices of those young unaccused. Oh, how their voices linger. Voices linger. Voices linger. Thank you.
Yes, there we go. Pirate Larry's collaborative tune with Teresa Clayton. I believe it's called Witch. It's as simple as that. Teresa, is that not the case?
That's the name of it. It's very simple. Witch.
Okay. And Pirate Larry, where can people pick up a copy of that if they like? You've got a CD out, I guess, that contains that track, along with a number of others, I'd imagine.
Yes, we do have a CD. It's on iTunes, or you can just play it for free. Go to YouTube/Piratas de Dios and look for Witch. Piratas de Dios is all one word. And we'll give you the link in the show notes. You know, we'll get you to where it is.
As always, indeed. So, okay, Teresa, we're running a little bit over schedule here. Hopefully we can, that's not too much of a problem. But, one, just to kind of like to wrap things up, talking a little bit more about Helloween just for just a couple minutes, if we could, and maybe any of the key points that we didn't hit on. We really didn't go into Helloween per se in the sort of depth that, I had thought we might, but that's fine. We got a great show out of it all the same. So just a quick little kind of overview synopsis of Helloween and its roots and things that maybe you think people should keep in mind over the course of the next a few days, which I believe, for example, Samhain, it is not just one day. It's a number of days, up to like a week or 10 days. And then of course, All Saints Day. So just, yeah, if you would, please.
Halloween, actually, it was not the precursor. Samhain is the precursor to Halloween. Samhain was actually practiced by the old Celts and the lesser Celts, which were the Druids, and the pagans. And again, like I said, they only had three seasons back then. There was the sowing season, the reaping season, and then the try to stay alive season. The last day of their year was Samhain. The first day of light is Imbolc, and then they would celebrate again at midsummer. And those were really the three main dividers of their seasons. They followed the moon. They followed the 13 full moons of the year. And that's how they lived their lives, very naturally through nature. Later on, they actually also had a love for their deceased. You know, sometimes you do people wrong, and you're afraid they're going to come back and get you. So they would leave food at the door after they went home from the bonfire. They would light their hearth, and then they would leave food outside the door just so the tricksters would leave them alone. While they were at the bonfire, though, they would dress up to mask themselves so that the dead wouldn't recognize them. And that's how you get your costumes and sort of things. Now, Halloween came into fashion in the late 1700s, and it's a Scottish thing. It was the Scots actually inherited that or devised that out of Samhain. And the word was actually meant more than just the dead. It meant magical lore. And was about the date where they popularized, it was popularized by a poem by Burns, I believe. And attached itself to Samhain. So it went from Samhain to All Hallows Eve, which comes right before All Saints Day and then All Souls Day. That's when the church came in and bastardized it. So that's the etymology of how that came about, and that kind of gives you a history of it as well. Now, on the Old Year's Night, which was the last year, the night of witches, the pagan holiday, that witches would come out and celebrate because they felt that was when they were given, that was when the height of their powers was on the last night of the year. So you witches in Halloween. Were carved to scare off the dead. Think of all the different things that, you know, that come about with Halloween. Samhain, which it goes back, gosh, over 2,000 years ago and was actually celebrated by the Celts.
Uh-huh.
The Druids were actually lesser Celts, and the pagans paganism was basically their belief system, for lack of a better word. Halloween, though, is now seen as just a pagan holiday. It isn't just a pagan holiday. It's actually a Sabbat, which is a very holy day to a pagan. It's a day when we do come out and we do lay all of our craft out. We don't hide that. Celts, Druids, pagans all believe that they have the power. They're not ashamed to show it. And on the last day of the year, they like to actually dance around and really put it out on display. So you'll see a lot of dancing with besoms and people who are dressed up, who all want to play the part. At sunset on October 31st, Samhain actually begins. Not the day of, it's at sunset on the 31st when it begins. And then all of the deities and all of the are given sacrifices. They burn animals. They would burn crops that didn't do well. They would sometimes make human sacrifices if they had enemies that they had captured. But during the celebration, the Celts wore costumes and danced around the bonfire. Many of them told stories and played out the cycles of life and death, commemorate the cycle of the Wheel of Life. Those costumes were adorned for three primary reasons. Basically, to honor the dead, to keep the bad dead from getting a hold of them, and to celebrate the fact that they were members of the craft, you know, that they give thanks and they gave thanks for a good reaping, and they also wanted to go out there and actually put their whole craft on display. And so they would do it with a great deal of aplomb. A lot of times they would do psychic readings at Samhain. At Samhain, when the veil is supposedly thin, I use that word very carefully because it's thin so many times during the course of a year. But it is thin at this particular time. This is the last day of the year to a pagan. And on that day, the doors open, and it's like everybody's invited to the party. So that's basically how that worked. Now then, when it came up into the time of that, the gentleman that I mentioned, his poem was the first actual mention of the word Halloween, Hallows Eve, those people who are holy. It preceded All Saints Day because back in the olden days, and even today in Judaism, their Sabbath starts at sunset, not the morning of. It's just the opposite, you can imagine. November 1st is the first day of their year. That's very important to them as well. Just to give you a little etymology on the word, Sao, it means summer, and Fruin, the wind part is end, so it's summer's end. It was also a Druid holiday. The Druids also, you know, saw it that way. But the Druids were more dark. They celebrated more of the dead and the evilness that was associated with it. And they were actually more of the Irish ilk rather than the Scottish. And let me just say that the people who are in the darkest parts of the world, those people in Sweden, and now even places like London, like England, Germany really embraced it. Russia embraced it. All of the Nordic countries embraced it. They love this stuff. They celebrate all of the pagan holidays with great aplomb and pay very little attention to Christian holidays. So a lot of my fans actually are from Sweden and Norway and Ireland and Scotland, England, Germany. Those are where most of my fans are. I wouldn't say that most of them were American. I think that the minute that they hear mysticism, it's an affront to their religion. They immediately just and walk away.
There's a couple of points here that are just kind of coming to mind. One, I believe, is it Krampus, if I'm not mistaken. I'm no authority on this, believe me, but that's just one of the names that has come to mind as far as the character of Krampus. Hope I'm not getting him mixed up with the Father Christmas, which I maybe, but on top of that, the bonfire, I believe that is derived from the bone fire. So there's something going on there as far as the burning of corpses and whatnot. But, and finally, just the word pagan actually simply means, a lot of people don't know this, but apparently it just means country dweller, country bumpkin kind of deal.
That is exactly right, and they spent an awful lot of time in their church.
Right,
you know, it was their church. As far as Krampus is concerned, and it's very close to the word given for Saint Nicholas. But Krampus is Bavarian, if I'm not mistaken. It's Bavarian Alpine folklore. Mm. Krampus is the horned half goat half demon. Who walks around at night, but I'm not so sure that that's only at Halloween. I think Krampus is something that haunts any time it wants to haunt. So, don't really know. I've not met Krampus.
Just to wrap things up here, too. Once again, going back to the pagan term, is very interesting. A lot of people don't pick up on this. I know I have, because I'm really interested in words. And, basically the word propaganda, if you look at that, right dab smack in the middle of things, you see the word pagan. Pro-pagan-da. For me, this is a no-brainer in the sense that the propaganda historically would come from the cities and the city center, Rome, all roads lead to Rome, and that the targets, Rome was, who were they targeting? The people out in the country, of course, with their proclamations and issuing of, declarations, statements, whatever pamphlets or whatever they put into circulation. So. I've had people that have said that's nonsense, that I'm totally off base there, but I don't think so. I think I'm onto something there with, the Sherlock Holmes kind of investigative and kind of inquiring mind sort of approach to the word etymology. So,
one of the things, there are so many things, because I just pulled it up for you. But I did find that 1853, in the literal sense, witch hunting from the 1630s, from witch hunt. The extended sense is attested from 1919 American English, later popularized in reaction to the Cold War anti-communism. So it did have something to do with those witch proclamations and the witch hunts. So you were right on kind of seeing that in the word. Etymology is something that fascinates me, because when you understand the meaning of a word or how a word comes about, it really changes everything for you. There's a C word that we all know that I won't say.
We can say crone, can't we?
Crone. But if you were to call me one today, I would not be offended, because it's actually the root word for kinship and country.
Yes, that, I think I know where we're going with this here. So, all right. And that is a term that you do hear on the pirate ship from time to time, but usually not within any woman's, presence. So out of just simple respect, but you are right there. I believe, yes, indeed, as you say, that it actually held, now it's more pejorative and derogatory, but historically was a word of great, it had more positive, meaning of import, I guess. But I think, that about, and you're right too with any words. If you're absolutely bang on there, I would totally agree, as would, that when you have a deeper understanding of these words that we use every day from moment to moment with, you know, an utterance of the language, but also on the receiving end, listening and hearing what it is that others have to offer, that if we can deconstruct and take a deeper approach and a deeper look, that there's power there, I believe.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
In the future, if anybody is interested in asking me questions about any of the things we talked about, like throwing bones, which is a way that they used to tell fortune, was throwing bones, not unlike runes, were used by the Norse or the cards that we put out on the tarot. So, you know, somebody mentioned scrying earlier, which really just was amazing. It was because I scry quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Scry into a fire, you can scry into a mirror, you can scry into water. You can scry into anything that's reflective or changes form. And scrying is a, I think, a fun way to get an idea of what is to come. Unfortunately, I'm not psychic, so I can't really tell the future, but I can scry for myself and I can see things. They're almost like an immediate thing, something coming up. So it's within a day or two, you know, or if I want an answer, I can scry.
Very common, yeah, practice, I guess, for people that are of the craft. And finally, the word witch, which I mean, it's ironic and unfortunate. I guess we say this for the end of the show, but apparently the word means simply, to bend in some way, or the word, I'm not sure exactly how that, if you can maybe just provide just a little more detail or clarification, what the word witch actually means. I'm not sure if we covered that yet or not. I don't think so, but it's kind of important for people to know, obviously.
Actually, the old word for witch is Wicca.
Right.
Now, but Wiccan didn't come into existence until about the late 60s, 70s when it really hit.
Gerald Gardner.
Yeah, it really came. That's pretty new. And neo-pagan is basically the same thing as Wiccan. It's a female magician or sorceress. And by the way, a man who is a witch is a witch, not
right.
A warlock.
Right.
Warlock, completely different thing. Nasty word.
Oathbreaker.
Okay, yes. Yeah, oathbreaker. Very, very bad thing. So a male witch and a female witch are both the same thing. A woman who has dealings with, according to the etymology page that you pull up when you look at this, I think it refers to, it's a woman who supposedly has dealings with Satan, maybe has sex with incubus, or, you know, it's just some of the most stupidest things you've ever heard in your life, you know, some of the most inaccurate things. But it does mean sorcerer. It does mean a person who is a master of the craft, of a magic. Magic meaning something that doesn't make any sense, doesn't have any common knowledge sense to it that you can prove one way or the other. So none of the ways that we would interpret witch today would be shocking to the people who were witches back in that day. We have what we call empirical science. Empirical science is the science we have from our own experiences. People who were back then, the Celts and the pagans, the Wiccans, if they knew what we defined witch as today, I think that they would be rolling in their graves, you know. The female, by the way, and a lot of these groupings, these townships, these little, you know, colonies, women were divine. The most divine of the two sexes, the two genders, and were held in very high esteem. And it wasn't until Christianity came along that women were suppressed and laid low and considered to be nothing more than chattel.
Well, We've gone for 2 hours now, believe it or not, and that's the way things sometimes go with the show. We like to keep it to 90 minutes, but the flow of things, sometimes it just, you know, it wants to make sure everything manages to kind of get out there for people and listening audiences' ears. So, but thank you, so much, Teresa, for being a part of things today, and Pirate Larry, thank you. Great job in tracking down your friend here and inviting her on board. So we're gonna end things now with your composition, Pirate Larry. Is there anything that you would you'd like to close on? Any just summary notes or anything that you have to comments or thoughts?
Keep your black kittens in the house. and meet us for the after show. All right. Talk to you later.
After show, especially whoever is related to Adeline or Adelaide or Addie.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll hopefully manage to get to the bottom of that when we transition to the back to the Rogues Gallery. So I think we're going to be all meeting up here at the Howling Wolf in just a few moments. It's a new watering hole that we haven't investigated or patronized up till this point. But Mossy Wench, the Scurvy Dog, they know us well there at those locations. So yeah, the Howling Wolf on tap for today. In the meantime, let's bring up, if we can, Teresa's number that she put together here with, if I can find it now, that is. So here we go, The Witch's Lust. Thanks, everybody, for being a part of things today. Episode 37 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, Jaffe Ryder, Chief Communications Officer of the Robin Hood. Signing off.
Stir the cauldron. Mix it well, so the souls we stole won't come back to tell of the monstrous sights that roam at night, that awful fright that sealed the spell and damned them all to that burning hell. Set the fire to a scalding blaze, and stand behind the ashen circle with your hands raised. No god comes near, no words of praise, just their screams and fear and their fixed gaze. The time has come to inhale the smoke of the witch's weed. The choke comes as your mind is freed. Off with your cloak. Let us now proceed. Dance and join hands. 'Tis not just chance that commands. All are joined together as one, and soon these tethers will come undone. No longer bound by bone and skin, bid the flame of the fire come in. Let it consume you and pleasure you without bounds. Lie down with the fire on the hard, cold ground. Let the flames lick you wherever you desire, and release that lustful pleading sound. More, cried out into the air, fill me, consume me. Spread me everywhere. The bodies writhe in ecstasy, filled with lust as their pleasures come to me and leave them spent beneath the settling dust. I open my legs to let them in, feel the lustful wanting churn. Now the dance takes a wicked turn as the fire inside of me begins to burn. I am filled with your desires. Quench your thirst and feed the fires. Pass the chalice so that all can awaken. Your lust was the power that has been taken and now resides inside of me. Will now bring me to my own ecstasy. Stir the cauldron. Call them to rise and step away from the boil. Call them to rise and plant their feet upon the soil. They are cleansed from their evil deeds. Their emanations have become the seeds that will sate that witch beneath Astera's moon. Many are they from these ejaculations that freed the needs and now incubate. The children bequeathed and now lie beneath the cold, hard ground until that splendid date when they will rise and again we will all commune
'Neath the darkened skies, The Witch's Lust, written by M. Teresa Clayton and recited by the saint.